Chapter 1. The HHV6 Conference and the Culture of Science. In science, there is maybe more self-interest, a little more paranoia, a little more narcissism, or else why do we go into it? You think you are good enough to solve problems of nature. Many scientists tend to keep things to themselves. If the other person does not get funded, maybe you will be funded. All these things are in play, but these are the worst elements of science or scientists. Dr. Robert Gallo. Barcelona, Spain, May 1st, 2006. Judy Mikovits searched for a seat just barely within earshot distance of the keynote speech of Dr. Robert Gallo at the 5th International Conference on HHV 6 and 7. Human Herpes Viruses 6 and 7. Gallo was speaking in the stately Grand Ballroom at the Hilton Diagonal Mar Hotel in Barcelona, Spain. She hoped to fade into the diffuse lighting and subtle European accents of the room. Mikovits knew from previous encounters that she wanted to stay far away from the famed scientist. Gallo was there to speak about human herpes virus number 6, which had been co-discovered in his lab in 1986 by Dr. Dharam Ablashi. Ablashi was also the program's committee chair of this conference dedicated to the HHV6 virus and its possible connection to ME/CFS and other disorders. Many Americans still consider Gallo to be the scientist who discovered the human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, which causes acquired immune deficiency syndrome, AIDS. The World Health Organization estimates that since the known onset of the AIDS epidemic in the early 1980s, 70 million people have become infected with the HIV virus, and about 30 million have died from the complications of AIDS, making it the greatest pandemic of the modern era, and ensuring a place among the Louis Pasteurs and Jonas Salks of history for those at the forefront of HIV research. Hence, the ferocious fight among the participants for credit. Gallo's biography at the Institute of Human Virology at the University of Maryland, which he founded and still directs, claims he is best known for his co-discovery of HIV. However, when the Nobel Prize Committee awarded the Nobel Prize in 2008 for the discovery of HIV to French scientists Luc Montagnier and Françoise Barré-Sinoussi, Gallo's name was conspicuously absent. One can't doubt the ascendant accolades and recognition Gallo has received during his scientific career. Gallo holds an enviable 29 honorary doctorates. In 1982 and 1986, he received the most prestigious American scientific award, the Lasker Prize, which is often called the American Nobel Prize for Medical Research. Gallo is the author of 1,200-plus scientific publications, and he authored the book Virus Hunting, AIDS, Cancer, and the Human Retrovirus, a Story of Scientific Discovery. According to Gallo's own account, he decided to devote his life to science after the untimely death of his younger sister at the age of 6 from leukemia. His story is an archetypal tale in science and medicine. Those personally touched by an illness often want to conquer or cure it. His career choice seemed to be his natural métier. Judy Mikovits made a similar decision to enter science after watching her beloved grandfather die of cancer, and later on her stepfather suffered the same fate. The dispute over who actually discovered the HIV retrovirus, whether it was Gallo or a French team led by Luc Montagnier, became so heated that in 1987 it required intervention by U.S. President Ronald Reagan and the French President Jacques Chirac. The truce was struck when Gallo conceded he likely used the French HIV isolate to develop the test and allowed both Gallo and Montagnier to claim credit as co-discoverers of the retrovirus. These events likely marked the first time in history that credit for a scientific discovery has been decided by two heads of state. P. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist John Crudson of the Chicago Tribune was paramount among Gallo's early HIV critics. In several articles over a three-year period, Crudson scrutinized many of Gallo's claims about his role in the discovery of the HIV retrovirus. Crudson's investigative reporting culminated in a book-length special supplement to the Tribune of 55,000 words in November of 1988, entitled The Great AIDS Quest. In a later article in 1992, the Chicago Tribune's public editor Douglas Nealon summarized Cruden's conclusions and the unresolved controversy. After noting that Gallo's lab had not discovered the AIDS virus as they long claimed, they had benefited from the resulting test. As a result, the United States has collected $20 million in patent royalties over the years from an AIDS test Gallo developed by using what even he now acknowledges was the French virus. Nealon finished his lengthy editorial by reflecting on what this investigation of high-profile science exposed about the pitfalls of money, ambition, and controversy. This case was not of abiding importance because it was typical. It was not. But as a worst-case example, it tells us about the treacherous quicksands greed and ambition place in the path of even professional truth-tellers in the scientific research community. And it shows too well what happens when politicians, bureaucrats, lawyers, and marketers get too close to science. Mikovits found that many of the same criticisms would be just as applicable to her investigation of the XMRV retrovirus and ME/CFS, her own version of treacherous quicksands that would entrap her in distortions and legal battles. But she was nothing like Robert Gallo. She had seen the illustrious scientist at close range at the very beginning of her scientific career and did not want to imitate him. 3 years of investigation by the Federal Office of Research Integrity culminated in a report they released on December 30, 1992, which found that Gallo had committed scientific misconduct. Gallo vigorously and vocally disputed the findings. However, on July 11, 1994, the Department of Health and Human Services stated, "A virus provided by the Institut Pasteur was used by the National Institute of Health scientists who invented the American HIV test kit in 1984 and promised the French $6 million in restitution." Shortly after this acknowledgement, Gallo left the NIH for a position at the University of Maryland. The Chicago Tribune reporter, John Crudson, would later turn the condemnatory information against Gallo into a 670-page book, Science Fictions, A Scientific Mystery, A Massive Cover-Up, and the Dark Legacy of Robert Gallo, which would be published in March of 2002. However, it wasn't as if Gallo had contributed nothing to the field of retroviral research or had never taken risky positions. He had pushed the science further, demonstrating that the HIV virus caused AIDS, using a technique developed in Gallo's lab by Frank Rossetti for growing T cells, an immune response cell which the virus was found to infect. He had also been among the few who took the renegade position that a retrovirus could cause human cancer at a time when it had been almost laughable to believe such a thing. Right before AIDS, cancer was the most feared national disease, and he seemed willing to take on a fearsome challenge. The scientists involved in the presidential dispute over HIV had also seemingly made peace with each other. When Montagnier was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2008, he wrote a gracious statement that Gallo was equally deserving of the award. The two would later collaborate on several papers regarding the scientific history of the AIDS epidemic. Maria Masucci, a member of the Nobel Assembly, had another take, telling the New York Times shortly after the awards were given, "There was no doubt as to who made the fundamental discoveries." The temporary truce between the two giants of retrovirology would deteriorate soon enough. Ironically, the break would not be over HIV/AIDS, but rather over autism. Despite collaborating on the greatest pandemic of modern history, the winds between Gallo and Montagnier shifted dramatically around this other underdog epidemic. On June 4, 2012, Gallo wrote a letter to the Chantelbia International Reference Center, an AIDS research center in the Central African nation of Cameroon, calling for Montagnier to be removed from his part-time position as scientific director. Gallo was joined in this effort by several others who, like Montagnier, were Nobel Prize winners. A June 19, 2012 article in Nature recounted Gallo's efforts and Montagnier's response. Montagnier deplores what he describes as ad hominem attacks and plain lies, and says that there is an ignominious campaign against him and his group. He says that history is full of pioneers whose ideas were at first given a chilly reception by a conservative research community. I believe this is happening again to me, and it is very sad that it involves Nobel Prize laureates attacking a fellow laureate, he says. The Nature article went on to detail what seems to have been the last straw justifying the efforts to remove Montagnier, his appearance at Autism One, a conference of autism parents and researchers in the field. Montagnier's theory was that abnormal bacteria were causing at least some of the symptoms of autism, and that long-term treatment with antibiotics might be helpful. But it seemed his greatest crime was in listening to autism parents describe what happened to their children. He says that he has never argued that vaccination could cause autism. Many parents have observed a temporal association, which does not mean causation, between a vaccination and the appearance of autism symptoms, he says. Presumably, vaccination, especially against multiple antigens, could be a trigger of a pre-existing pathological situation in some children. Parents of children with autism were understandably frustrated that the scientific community disregarded that some of them noticed their children's symptoms worsened or that health problems began shortly after the child was vaccinated. Like Montagnier, Mikovits was not into arbitrary social divisions. She didn't like being told who to shun. She felt parents tended to be honest and accurate reporters about their own children. If she wanted to talk to an autism parent, she was going to talk to an autism parent. Being an aisle crosser just didn't always make her popular amongst spotlight grabbers. One of the greatest thrills of her professional life came when she delivered a speech immediately following Montagnier, and the Nobel Prize winner directed the discussion toward her presentation and its ramifications. Then, in a private conversation following the presentation, Montagnier commented on the XMRV controversy, compared it to his own battle with Gallo over HIV, and told her, "Don't let the critics get you down." Dr. Frank Rossetti, Mikovits's mentor and longtime collaborator, was inclined to take a less charitable view of Gallo than Montagnier had offered on the morning he won the Nobel Prize. Rossetti had seen Robert Gallo at close range, working in his lab from 1975 to 1982. Dr. Kendall Smith, a professor of medicine and immunology at Cornell University, recalled meeting Rossetti during those early years at Gallo's lab as he worked on interleukin-2, IL-2, a protein molecule that regulates the body's immune system, saying, "I always describe him as a cross between Leonardo da Vinci and Rocky Marciano, because he is truly a pure intellectual, probably the most well-read scientist I know, and he never pulls punches." Even before he joined her in later battles, Mikovits agreed that Rossetti was one of the most brilliant, well-rounded men she had ever met. She saw him as both honest and incorruptible. These qualities and Mikovits's appreciation of them would form the basis of a more than 30-year collaboration and friendship. Mikovits proclaimed that nobody on Earth knew her as well as Frank Rossetti, as he had the soul-peering ability of an honestly lived life. Smith's fond memories of Frank Rossetti stand in sharp contrast to what he told the reporter Seth Roberts of Spy magazine in 1990 about Robert Gallo's reaction to his work. When, in 1988, Kendall Smith published a paper in the prestigious journal Science that accurately described the discovery of IL-2, Gallo was infuriated and phoned Smith from an AIDS conference in Stockholm. "Kendall, I haven't read it, but people tell me you were not nice to me." It is a peculiar habit of Gallo's to claim he hasn't read or seen or heard whatever he is vociferously criticizing. The article in Spy magazine also provided an account of the discovery of HTLV-1, the first known human retrovirus. It highlighted Gallo's reaction and Frank Rossetti's response to Gallo's attempt to take credit. In 1978, Bernie Poise arrived at the Gallo lab for a postdoctoral fellowship and was put under the tutelage of Rossetti. For years, Gallo's lab had been looking for retroviruses that infected myeloid cells, as retroviruses were known to cause cancer in animals. Researchers wondered whether they could do the same in humans. With Rossetti's help, Poise found a retrovirus within months, and the two of them planned to publish an article on the discovery. Then Gallo called Rossetti down to his office and suggested Poise be taken off as first author. Rossetti refused. Gallo told him he was unlikely to get far in life with an attitude like that. Poise compares the discovery of HTLV-1 to the Celtics winning an NBA championship. Poise was like Larry Bird, Rossetti was like the coach, and Gallo was like the general manager. Yet in the decade that followed, Gallo, who had not done any lab work for years, received almost all the credit. Although Mikovits would never work directly under Gallo, she found herself locking horns with Gallo and NIH officials at her very first research job, and like Rossetti, she would not back down. "Science is a very difficult thing to do well," said Frank Rossetti in 2013, reflecting on his research career of more than 40 years and experience as the senior investigator and head of the leukocyte biology section in the Laboratory of Experimental Immunology at the National Cancer Institute. "And there are two ways to get ahead. You can struggle in the lab, work your tail off, and get some publications. The problem with that approach is that it's a profession which relies on the integrity of individuals to be anonymous. Anonymous in getting funding, anonymous in reviewing manuscripts, and that anonymity depends on the integrity of the individual." In Rossetti's opinion, Gallo's brand of ruthless jockeying is common in research, as many scientists become intoxicated by scientific celebrity and quickly throw away their integrity. As in any field, science could involve substantial social networking and favoritism. Then there are a group of scientists who believe it's never important to be first, but to be second and third, and write the first review article, said Rossetti. Those scientists will then use political connections to convince the world they're great. And unfortunately, our field is full of people like that, and they tend to be the more famous ones. Rossetti recalled an incident in the early 1980s when he went to see two leading scientists about obtaining some HIV samples for research. The scientists were happy to share the samples, but one couldn't stop talking about how much he hoped this research would land him a spot on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. To Rossetti, there seemed to be a lust for the limelight, a great man complex, when in truth, science should be a collaborative process. In Rossetti's view, this thirst for personal glory and recognition threatened the purity of science. Mikovits had entered her early professional life with enthusiastic determination. She graduated from the University of Virginia in May of 1980 with a BA in biological chemistry. She was the only one of the four children in her family to go to a four-year university. Recognizing her promise, Anne Harp Peabody, a high school English teacher at Jeb Stuart High in Falls Church, Virginia, was instrumental in getting Mikovits the financial aid to attend. Right before Mikovits's graduation from college, Time magazine ran a cover story on March 30, 1980, about the discovery of interferon, which held the possibility of being a cure for cancer. From the day her grandfather had died several years earlier of cancer, Mikovits promised him and herself that this disease would not devastate other families as it had done hers. As with Gallo, her familial history of disease had thrust her into cancer research with a sense of calling. She also didn't want to waste any time getting started. On the Sunday following graduation, she saw a job listing in the Washington Post for a protein chemist to purify interferon as a biological treatment against kidney cancer in a lab contracted under the NCI in Frederick, Maryland. She applied for the job and landed it. In 1982, Gallo contracted to Mikovits and her colleagues the task of purifying HTLV-1 retrovirus from infected cells grown in 250-liter fermenters using a continuous flow centrifuge. But there were risky issues with his methodology. Mikovits and her supervisor felt that the growing conditions for the retrovirus were unsafe for the lab workers, especially since there were several pregnant young women on staff. The hazards to a developing fetus were at that time unknown, and they wanted more safeguards. According to Mikovits, they brought these concerns to the supervisors, who were unbending and demanded that they go ahead and grow the retrovirus or sacrifice their jobs. Mikovits and her boss decided to do the work around the clock by themselves and still managed to complete the project on time, not putting any pregnant workers in harm's way. A few months later, Mikovits received a letter from her boss that the NCI no longer needed a protein chemist to purify interferon. She couldn't help but feel that the same dysfunctional environment that allowed Gallo to thrive was now turned against her as payback because she was a 24-year-old lab technician who dared to challenge a lionized scientist. The guardians of public health had shown reckless disregard for the well-being of their own lab workers, even pregnant women, handling a poorly understood pathogen. What did this say about their concern for the rest of the public? After her position was eliminated, she attended a seminar given by Dr. Jost J. Oppenheim. After his engrossing talk, she approached Oppenheim to discuss his current research. He invited her to his office, and when she mentioned her position at the NCI lab had ended, he suggested she talk to Frank Rossetti, who Oppenheim had just hired as a principal investigator in his laboratory. Mikovits was certain after the fact that she had blown the Rossetti interview, but it actually left quite a favorable impression with the scientist. When Rossetti went to notify the personnel director to hire Mikovits, he was told no, with the rationale that Mikovits was a troublemaker. "How is she a troublemaker?" Rossetti queried. "She asks too many questions." "But she's a scientist," he replied with outrage. "It's her job to ask questions." That settled it for him. Rossetti insisted that they hire Mikovits and won his battle. A few months later, Mikovits got a call from Robert Gallo, followed by Vince DeVita, who was head of the NCI. They wanted to take a look at a paper Rossetti was writing confirming the isolation of HIV from blood and body fluids. Rossetti was attending an overseas scientific convention in Europe at the time, and thus could not weigh in. Since Mikovits did not hold authorship, she told them she could not ethically give the paper to them. They threatened then to fire her for insubordination. Insubordination seems to be a recurring theme in the ongoing career of Mikovits, earning respect from her supporters and angering her critics. Mikovits told Gallo and DeVita she wasn't going to hand over the paper. Mikovits challenged them to go ahead and fire her. When Frank returned from Europe and learned what she had done, he was incredulous. "You did that for me?" he asked. The stress of the past few weeks and the fear that she could be fired for a second time for standing up to powerful men got the better of her, and she angrily lashed out. "I didn't do it for you. I did it because it was the right thing to do." Rossetti was impressed and bemused by the brassy courage of his young protege. This was clearly a very special young woman. Shortly after Mikovits told Rossetti what had happened in his absence, he got a call from Gallo. "You know, Frank, the NIH can't afford to have two different labs discovering this. You have to send me your virus to make sure it's the same as my virus." But Rossetti had been down too many dark alleys with Gallo to enter his circle of trust. Rossetti replied, "Well, thanks, but no thanks. Congratulations on confirming the isolation. But I'm going to flush my virus down the toilet rather than give it to you." Rossetti would later observe that there were a number of dominant people in science who believed things were true simply because they spoke with an authoritative utterance. Their underlings lived in fear of them because of how they could change the trajectory of a researcher's career. Unfortunately, a commanding phrase could take on a life of its own, outlasting even its definitive disproof, which was how some dominant figures rose to the upper echelon of the scientific hierarchy, in Rossetti's estimation. "Gallo's a classic example," said Rossetti. "Unfortunately, there are a lot of people like him in science." When Gallo hit a crosswind several years later regarding his claim to have discovered the HIV retrovirus before Montagnier and Barré-Sinoussi, Mikovits and Rossetti weren't exactly surprised to see him sputtering against a backlash. However, there was no such controversy surrounding the discovery of human herpes virus number 6, HHV6. The dispute surrounding HHV6 would be about its possible connection to various debilitating or deadly human diseases. Working at Gallo's lab a few years after Rossetti had left, doctors Syed Zaki Salahuddin and Dharam Ablashi first reported the isolation of the virus. Pictures of white blood cells which had swelled, earning the nickname juicy cells, showed they had been infected by the virus. These findings were published in the journal Science in October of 1986. The infected cells appeared to be B cells, but the virus also seemed to target T4 lymphocytes, otherwise known as CD4 cells, a key part of the immune system. Patients with AIDS soon tested positive for the newly discovered herpes virus, which may not have been initially groundbreaking, since AIDS patients tested positive for numerous opportunistic infections, including others in the herpes virus family. Then reports filtered into Gallo, Salahuddin, and Ablashi that the so-called juicy cells were seen in other patients with unrelated immune system disorders, including young children with seizures, as well as adults and children with blood disorders, kidney problems, or ME/CFS. Of course, this raised the question of what causal factors could create commonality in these seemingly disparate hits to the immune system, and which virus or retrovirus was the driver, and which ones were passengers. Even after more than 20 years, the question remains unanswered whether the HHV6 virus lies at the heart of many serious diseases, or whether it is just another telltale indicator of an even more elusive pathogen, or type of pathogen, which is decimating the immune system of its victims and leading the reactivation of dormant bugs or invasion by new bugs. However, with AIDS, the 1-2 punch of HIV and its co-infections became textbook information. HIV compromised the immune system, leading to secondary opportunistic infections. To treat AIDS, antiretroviral drugs had to be used as primary treatment, with treatment for secondary infections as a next line of course, because this was the way to deal with the 1-2 punch. Treating opportunistic infections alone in the early years of AIDS had resulted in gravely shortened lifespans and massive carnage, even when it did prolong life. In late 2005, Mikovits was smiling and at ease in one of her favorite spots, tending bar at the Pierpoint Bay Yacht Club, PBYC, in the Ventura Harbor in Ventura, California, not far from the beach house she shared with her husband, David. There were no membership fees required to join the club, and annual dues were minimal, giving the club a class-straddling joviality unreachable in many similar places. However, the small dues required that the facility run on volunteerism. Members were required to partake in various duties at the clubhouse at least once a year. Judy and David Noldy did much more than the minimal duties. In addition to being rear commodore of the yacht club, Noldy, among their friends she is known as Judy Noldy, while professionally she retains the Mikovits name, liked filling in regularly as the bartender. The job allowed her to open up the club in the late afternoon or in early evening, pour beer and wine, clear her mind with the heft of a Pinot Noir in one hand, and connect with a diverse group of people. She loved the relaxed banter, hearing about the struggles and obstacles people had overcome. If asked, she would freely share tales of her own life. She regaled the patrons with stories about her more than 20 years working at the National Cancer Institute in Maryland. Or, if they were in the mood for romance, she told them about meeting David at a conference in Ventura in 1999, getting married at the age of 42, commuting for a few months between the NCI on the East Coast and David's home in Ventura, and finally deciding that if she wanted a real marriage, she needed to be in the same time zone as her husband. It was his gentle magnetism that brought her there, to a place where an accomplished scientist might be found tending bar at an egalitarian yacht club. To be nearer to David, she got a job as director of cancer research with a biotech startup in Santa Barbara called Epigenix Pharmaceuticals, which was developing drugs to regulate tumor suppressor genes, leading to more effective outcomes for cancer treatment. The drugs they were developing decreased DNA methylation. Increased DNA methylation caused silencing of gene expression, which normally becomes disrupted as cancer spread through the body, thus causing further downstream damage. The intellectual property for the company was licensed out of the University of California at Santa Barbara, UCSB, and Judy was intimately involved in the construction of the lab Epigenix built, as well as securing 2 SBIR grants from the NIH. The company had floundered in the wake of the sluggish economic climate after 9/11. In the spring of 2005, it was in the process of being bought out by a larger company. Epigenix had generated a fair amount of its own intellectual property, but with no funding to pay employees, Mikovits was the only actual lab employee left. She would still go into the lab every day and run experiments, but the company had also put her in charge of handling due diligence for the upcoming sale, which took a few hours every day. Mikovits knew that when the sale went through, she would in all likelihood need to look for a new job. The sale wouldn't take place for several months, so on one Friday evening in late 2005, Judy found herself working behind the bar when then-Vice Commodore of PBYC, Joe Vetrano, walked in with his new girlfriend, Karen, an accountant. It would prove to be a moment of serendipity, with Judy's candor working in her favor. The three of them chatted for a while, and Karen started to talk about her boss, who had a daughter tragically sick with an illness believed to be caused by a human herpes virus, HHV6. Judy was intrigued as Karen conveyed the substantial level of impairment and suffering of her boss's child. Karen's boss, Kristen Loomis, had started an organization to go after the virus, called the HHV6 Foundation. After Karen had talked for several minutes and Judy excitedly asked a few questions, Joe initiated offhandedly, "Judy, maybe you could help them." "Yes, Joe, why not? I'll check it out," she replied with a grin, taking away their finished drinks. Ken Richards joined Epigenex in September of 2000 as chief financial officer and recalled recruiting Mikovits from the NCI in May of 2001. Ken was originally from Canada, having worked for 17 years for a Canadian corporate investment bank before transferring with them to Los Angeles in 1997. He was surprised as a savvy money man to find that the University of California at Santa Barbara, UCSB, had a phenomenal science and engineering program, but no systematic way to bring their research discoveries to market. Richards and two other ambitious partners founded the Santa Barbara chapter of Tech Coast Angels, the largest angel funding network in the United States. It was at a meeting for Tech Coast Angels that Ken was introduced to Epigenex, and through that company he would meet Mikovits. He later gushed about her, "Judy was a very well-spoken, knowledgeable, and dedicated scientist who wanted to do everything possible to find effective treatments for cancer," said Richards. On the question of why Mikovits seemed to have both strong supporters and critics, Richards said, "I tell everybody, Judy is very controversial. Many people do not like her, and many people admire her. I am in the latter category. She speaks her mind. When she develops a view, she is dedicated to that view and will defend it fiercely. She's combative in a positive sense, and that tends to irritate some people." Richards believed that many of Mikovits's detractors had fallen victim to an unconscious form of sexism, in which an assertive woman was viewed as a bitch, while a man making a similarly impassioned defense of his position would be admired and respected for his firm stance. It seemed like the kind of post-feminist statement that perhaps only a man could make and be fully heard, especially regarding a disease like ME/CFS that was incorrectly thought to only affect women and had been derogatorily referred to as yuppie flu in its early years, with mocking press implying that women contracting the disease were overly driven. Even though Mikovits would eventually leave Epigenex, her tie with Richards would remain solid, and he would remain a steadfast supporter. In 2011, Richards was putting together a private equity firm to invest in early-stage technology and biotechnology companies. "We needed somebody with a strong science background. The first person I thought of was Judy Mikovits." When a few higher-ups asked questions about bringing on this controversial figure, Richards had several cards to play on Judy's behalf. In addition to a recommendation from the respected Frank Rossetti, Nobel Prize winner Luc Montagnier was very supportive of Judy and wrote highly of her work and her integrity when he penned a recommendation to the York Bridge management. After her chance run-in at the yacht club, Mikovits did some cursory research on HHV-6, and within a few hours felt comfortable that she understood most of the issues, mainly the question of whether HHV-6 initiated the disease process or was simply a consequence of a poorly functioning immune system. The questions were much the same as they had been in HIV/AIDS research. Her doctoral thesis had in fact been on the development of AIDS from HIV infection. She had the curious experience of defending her thesis shortly after the basketball player Magic Johnson had announced he had tested positive for HIV in November of 1991. Because Johnson was such a beloved sports star and defied widespread stereotypes about who got AIDS and who didn't, his revelation had shaken the country and cracked open borders for marginalized groups. The focus of the committee at her thesis defense was the question, "Based on your thesis, do you think Magic Johnson will ultimately develop and die of AIDS?" The soon-to-be Dr. Mikovits answered that she thought Johnson's long-term prospects looked good. His infection appeared to have been recently acquired, so if he took the recently developed antiretroviral therapy, ART, that prevented the HIV virus from replicating and integrating into tissue reservoirs of the monocyte and macrophages, it would never cause the immune deficiency. For Johnson, HIV might not be able to establish itself in hidden reservoirs if they started him on the antiretrovirals quickly after his initial infection. In all likelihood, Mikovits told her thesis committee then, Johnson could look forward to an average lifespan. Nearly 14 years later, as Mikovits sat down to write an email to Loomis in November 2005, she reflected on Johnson's continuing good health, which many would have thought magical thinking in 1991. She included her resume in the email and details of the upcoming sale of Epigen-X. Loomis emailed Mikovits back within a few hours, and they made plans to meet at Loomis's house in Montecito. They talked for much of the afternoon. Loomis said she was interested in bringing Mikovits on staff in some sort of research capacity. Oblashi had the title of research director, so that would remain with him. But some position would be found for Mikovits. Mikovits wrote an excited email to Rossetti about the job offer, noting how much she disliked the turmoil of Epigen-X's pending sale, being put in charge of due diligence for the sale, and that, more than anything else, she wanted to get back to working with patients and doing research. Rossetti was a little more cautious, hesitant about the involvement of Oblashi. He thought Oblashi was cut from the same cloth as Gallo, and part of what had gone wrong in retrovirology in the past 30 years, turning what should have been a collaborative search for truth about the greatest scourge of recent history into a cruel and brutish competition for individual glory. Against the advice of Rossetti, Mikovits took the job. Within the first couple of weeks she worked as a consultant for the HHV-6 Foundation, Mikovits took Loomis to her lab at Epigen-X. Loomis was excited over the large freezer they had at the facility, and explained that she worked with Dr. Daniel Peterson, a physician in Incline Village, who, along with Dr. Paul Cheney, stumbled upon and then started treating the walking wounded from the first modern outbreak of what was called at the time chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, at Lake Tahoe in 1984-1985. The name would later be changed to myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome, MECFS. It was a surreal reality for these small-town doctors in the placid setting nestled in the mountains, like being in a remote area of the Alps unaware that it was wartime and finding an office filled with never-before-seen injuries. The patients kept stumbling into the practice in Incline Village, as baffled as the doctors, while Peterson and Cheney tried to take detailed testing and records with little certainty about what to offer beyond symptomatic treatments. Peterson reputedly had a repository of blood samples dating back to that first outbreak, which would be ideal for research. Mikovits dreamed of the diagnostic tests she could run on the blood. Loomis told Mikovits that she and Peterson should write papers together, since that was not one of Peterson's strengths, whereas Mikovits had more than 40 published articles to her name. After the initial burst of excitement of the first couple weeks, though, there was a disconnect between what Mikovits thought she would be doing and what she was assigned. Mikovits figured a bright spot might be preparing for the 5th International Conference on HHV 6 and 7, to be held later that year in Barcelona, Spain. Loomis wanted her to find companies and individuals to sponsor the meeting. She knew that Mikovits had many contacts from her years at the NCI and her years in the biotech field. Mikovits reviewed the abstracts for the conference, knowing the rigorous standards the pharmaceutical companies and scientific experts would expect. After reading the abstracts, she grew more despondent. There was no real uniformity to the papers, and Mikovits felt she could not present the idea of sponsoring the conference to any of her colleagues, due to the fact there was so little actual science in any of them. It wasn't necessarily a criticism of the scientists. It was largely a reflection of the paltry level of funding given to study the virus. Without serious money given to study a problem, nobody could be expected to produce high-quality science. Loomis was upset when Mikovits said she couldn't find any sponsors for the conference among the scientists and organizations she knew. After those aimless early weeks, and after talking it over with her husband, Mikovits made a decision. She had promised to go to the meeting in Barcelona, but when the conference was over, she would leave the HHV 6 Foundation and look for another job. Barcelona, Spain, May 1st, 2006. Gallo finished his dinner talk, and Mikovits was glad she had been able to avoid listening too closely. The pharmaceutical reps at her table had been lively company. To the public, Gallo was still a respected figurehead, but some viewed him as somebody who had been saved because a true accounting of his misconduct would have been a stain on the prestige of American science. After Gallo's talk, there was an award being given to one of the members of the board of directors of the HHV 6 Foundation, Annette Whittemore. Mikovits knew the name, but had not otherwise been aware of the Whittemores until the award announcement and the letter written by her husband Harvey as a prelude. Mikovits learned that Annette's father had been a doctor for small rural communities in eastern Nevada. Later, Mikovits would learn that Annette's father had delivered all of Senator Reed's children. Annette also had a degree in special education and had worked for several years with children who had autism. She appeared a bit overwhelmed by the tribute, kindly thanking the group before quickly exiting the stage. As Annette stepped down from the podium, Mikovits couldn't help but reflect on the contents of Harvey's letter, detailing what a loving, virtuous person Annette seemed to be. Just the kind of person Mikovits wanted to be around. Barcelona, Spain, May 3rd, 2006. Dan Peterson gave the morning presentation on the final day of the conference. He was listed in the program as Principal Investigator, Chronic Fatigue Syndrome and Immune Dysfunction Syndrome, out of Incline Village, Nevada. It was only fitting he should have such an exalted title, given his association with MECFS ever since it had appeared amongst those snow-capped peaks in 1984 and 1985. Mikovits sat in the back of the room, thinking she had only a few more hours left of the conference, and her attention was waning a bit, when Peterson came to his last slide. The slide contained data from 16 people with MECFS and the various cancers they had developed over time, which obviously piqued her interest after so many years at the National Cancer Institute. In addition to the cancers, the slide showed the results of their immune cell testing. The T cells showed some unusual abnormalities known as clonal rearrangements. This meant instead of making many different generalized T cells to target all of the pathogens that might appear, these patients' cells seemed to be focused on a singular insult, leaving their immune systems vulnerable to other invaders, as if the cells were obsessively staring down the crosshairs of a gun at one target, while other invaders snuck in from behind. This piqued Mikovits's attention because T cells eliminate virus and cancer cells, and abnormalities meant the body would have a reduced ability to fight off a viral pathogen. A chronic viral infection lying in wait for many years might end up causing a cancer. Mikovits also saw on the slide a few mantle cell lymphoma cases. At the time, she was participating in a cancer support group in Ventura, and a few of those women also had mantle cell lymphoma. Mikovits's years at the NCI working with Rossetti had drilled into her the idea that whenever one saw a cluster occurrence of illnesses, one should think about pathogenic causes. This dictum wasn't always true, but it was a logical place to start. Peterson told the assembled group that he didn't know what the unusual T-cell abnormality meant, and stated that if anybody had any idea, they should come up and talk to him. Mikovits nearly sprinted up to the podium to grab his attention. They talked for several minutes, and Peterson was enthusiastic about her expertise, and invited her up to Incline Village to look over his files and talk with patients. She would meet with the Whittemores and with Peterson, who was treating the Whittemores' aforementioned daughter, Andrea, to see if there were any ways she might assist their efforts. Mikovits also thought she might be able to link the mystery of the T-cell abnormality to the pathogenesis of MECFS. Exciting collaborations seemed to be afoot, and Mikovits was unexpectedly looking toward Nevada, a state that had used the slogans Wide Open and Battle Born. Both slogans would prove prescient for her as she ventured into what seemed to be a wide-open field of possibility and found herself battling bullying opposition and intangible demons. Reno had hosted its own slogans and nicknames over the years, too, such as A Little West of Center and Far From Expected, catchphrases that seemed to connote a climate of broad-minded risk-taking that would welcome an insubordinate scientist who stuck to her guns.